Essential workers risked their lives to support Americans during the pandemic, but who's supporting them?
A lack of personal protective equipment, not providing workers with paid sick leave when they do get sick, and just a lack of transparency from employers.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, July 28th, how employers could pass the buck to employees if they get sick from coronavirus. Also on the show, it's been 30 years since the Americans with Disabilities Act, but physical barriers still remain an issue in cities across the country.
The law was not set up to create a sudden overnight transformation.
And in lieu of a summer song this summer, we take it back to a classic from the 90s.
Just like they're injecting nostalgia into my veins.
But first up, we have to contend with hurricane season during a pandemic, so let's get started.
Any hurricane is an enormous challenge. This challenge is complicated and made even more severe, seeing that it is sweeping through an area that is the most challenged area in the state for COVID-19.
That was Texas Governor Greg Abbott speaking on Saturday. Over the weekend, Hurricane Hanna, a Category 1 storm, made landfall in parts of southern Texas. So far, 140,000 residents have lost power, and people living in several coastal counties were encouraged to evacuate their homes. The storm comes as coronavirus cases continue to increase in Texas, putting evacuees at risk of contracting the virus.
I had a patient who told me that because her electricity ran out, her oxygen concentrator wasn't working, nor were her treatments, nebulizers. Therefore, she had to find a place to plug in, which finally was at her mother's house. However, she was afraid to infect her mother and her younger siblings who lived in that house. So she stayed literally in her Jeep, in the car, in the garage, plugged in from her oxygen supply. And she said, crying in despair.
That's Dr. Ivan Melendez from the Hidalgo County Health Authority, who told us how healthcare workers in Texas were faring.
Access to the hospitals were limited during the storm. And so nurses, instead of working 12 hours, some stayed as long as 20, fatigued and exhausted because of the traveling back and forth.
Texas is just one of several states, including Florida, Louisiana, and North Carolina, facing the risk of hurricanes amid rising COVID-19 cases. And hurricane season is just getting started. Joining me now are Tom Frank, climate impacts reporter at E&E News, and Reynaldo Leaños Jr., a border and immigration reporter with Texas Public Radio. Thanks to you both for being with me.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Reynaldo, let's start with you. Reynaldo, you've been covering Hurricane Hanna from the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. What's the latest? Is power restored?
Yeah, I mean, so as of last night, there are still many people, you know, without power. I mean, I was kind of scrolling, you know, through social media and connecting with people, and some people are not expected, you know, to receive power, get their power back until as late as Friday or Saturday. So while a lot of people have been restored, you know, with their power and stuff, there are still many who, you know, haven't had that happen for them yet.
And Reynaldo, we heard Governor Abbott at the top of the segment here saying that this storm, Hanna, has really impacted and affected some of the more vulnerable parts of the state. You're reporting in the Rio Grande Valley, where more than a third of the families are living in poverty. And we know that there are more than 26,000 cases of coronavirus across four counties in Texas. Has Hurricane Hanna made efforts to contain the pandemic worse in the Rio Grande Valley?
Yeah, I mean, so it's been interesting, you know. I mean, I grew up in the Rio Grande Valley. You know, we've had tropical storms and et cetera before. But there has been such a heightened concern, you know, about how to deal with this, you know, with the virus ongoing and the aftermaths of the hurricane. I mean, for example, shelters have opened up over the weekend and whatnot. And it was interesting because part of like the guidelines for going to the shelter is that you had to, you know, kind of still maintain social distancing. You had to, you know, wear a face mask. You know, when there were water rescues out, people were instructed, you know, to try to maintain social distancing. But, you know, that was very difficult to do in water rescues and stuff. So there is a concern, you know, and there's such a different approach, you know, of like post-hurricane stuff that is happening. I mean, when you have to also be considering all the COVID surge that has been happening down here in the region.
Tom, how does coronavirus affect things in terms of how states and municipalities are preparing for a hurricane right now?
It makes everything much more complicated because of the social distancing guidelines that have been put out by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and FEMA in terms of maintaining social distancing in evacuation shelters. Basically, the states and counties are having to at least double the number of shelters that they need to open so that you can give people much more space inside the shelters, so they are maintaining social distancing. And the other thing that states and counties are trying to do, which is not so easy, is to reserve hotel rooms so that people really can maintain that separation. The problem you run into is, first of all, a lot of areas that are vulnerable to hurricanes don't have hotel rooms in that are outside of the evacuation zones. So when you think about where do people put hotel rooms, well, they, you know, they put them right on the coast. And where do hurricanes go? Well, they go right to the coast. So there's no use reserving a bunch of hotel rooms, you know, on Miami Beach if you're just going to have to evacuate. So it's a real problem finding adequate and available space to shelter people. And what's really going to end up happening is people just aren't going to evacuate. And that creates a whole new set of possible complications if people ignore evacuation orders.
I want to talk a little bit about that. Reynaldo, are you finding in your reporting, specifically in the Rio Grande Valley, were there residents there who were reluctant to evacuate? Or how did they feel generally about the government's response to the storm?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, kind of going off what we just talked about right now, you know, also, it's just like you, people do have to make a choice, you know, it's like, do they risk, you know, possibly becoming infected and going, you know, to a shelter, being around other people, or staying at home? But I think one interesting thing about the Rio Grande Valley is that a lot of these homes, you know, I mean, where we live, it's like, there's a lot of like multi-generational, you know, family members living together in a space. And I think one of the problems that has been down here also is that it's very hard, you know, to social distance even at home when there's like several family members, you know, living together. But in terms of the overall, I guess, feel of the response, you know, I think some of that is still yet to come. You know, I think that there have been, you know, obviously like efforts to, you know, deflood areas or pick up debris. And there was rescue efforts, you know, both from the local and state partnerships that were helping with that. But I think, I mean, with FEMA money that's supposed to be coming in, I think we'll kind of see, you know, how people feel. But there is a sense, you know, in my community that Governor Abbott, you know, has not done enough, at least in terms of COVID, you know, response. So I know there's a protest later today because he's supposed to be visiting, but there's several people from the community that are expected to protest his visit.
Tom, off of that point, I mean, are states and municipalities funded adequately to deal with these disasters? You're mentioning getting hotel rooms, and that probably isn't very inexpensive. What are the funding apparatuses right now for dealing with this sort of the double whammy of a hurricane and the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, you've really got a tale of two cities there, because funding comes largely from FEMA. FEMA generally pays 75% of costs of disaster response and recovery, and that's helpful. And FEMA right now has never had more money in its history. It is absolutely flush with cash. When Congress passed the CARES Act back in March, it gave FEMA $45 billion for disaster relief. So
that's billion with a B.
Billion with a B, which basically doubled, more than doubled the amount of money in the Disaster Relief Fund, which is the fund, the pot of money that pays for anything from opening shelters to repairing bridges. At the same time, states and counties are in horrible financial shape because the economic slowdown has really dried up a lot of the revenues, like tax revenues, sales tax revenues. So on the one hand, FEMA's got a lot of money. On the other hand, states and counties, which have that 25% cost share, are really in tough financial shape. And it wouldn't surprise me if you started to see a lot of states asking FEMA to go beyond the standard 75% reimbursement and pay, you know, 90%, maybe 100%, by saying, look, FEMA, you've got the money. We don't. We can't afford it. And this is what you exist for.
Tom, another issue here, as we know, is that some of these states, Texas has seen an increase, a severe increase in coronavirus cases. Florida, you mentioned Miami earlier, it's another one of the epicenters now of the coronavirus pandemic in the United States, with cases skyrocketing. All of that has led to delays and backlogs in many of the hospitals and ICUs in these states. What's the situation when you add a hurricane to that mix in terms of being able to provide emergency health care for folks?
Well, the situation is not good. And if you actually look at the states that have seen the biggest increase in COVID-19 cases since, say, June 1st, the start of the hurricane season, it's almost the exact same map as the states that are most vulnerable to hurricanes. So it's Florida, it's Texas, it's Louisiana, it's North Carolina. Those are the states that are getting hit hardest by the surge in COVID. And those are also the states that are having the biggest problem with their hospitals being at or near capacity. So the problem you're going to end up with is you may not have enough beds, but really an almost bigger problem is medical personnel. And the FEMA administrator testified about this in Congress on Friday, and the Washington Post had a story about it yesterday, that the real issue is that there just aren't enough medical personnel out there. And because the coronavirus is a national disaster, that's going to prevent states from sending their medical personnel from, say, New York to Florida, because everyone needs their medical personnel. So this sort of mutual aid that has been a hallmark of disaster response in this country for decades is not going to be available the way it's traditionally been. And that's going to create real shortages. You know, you're going to talk about eliminating a lot of, you know, elective procedures. That's already happening in places like Texas.
We've been through that here in New York, and we are opening up again. But I understand the point. I mean, this is, you know, one of the high points of hurricane season. So things need to be considered here. I just want to get Reynaldo before we go. We have about a minute left in the segment. Is Governor Abbott doing anything specific to prepare for the rest of the hurricane season? Reynaldo, we got a minute left.
Yeah, I mean, I really do think that, like, this first hurricane, you know, of the season, you know, will kind of, you know, be able to look at down the line, you know, to see kind of what went well, what didn't work and stuff. And I think, like, working with the local governments, you know, I think Abbott's supposed to be coming down to the valley today to meet with local officials to see what else is needed and stuff. So I believe that will be some of the conversation, you know, to see how to better prepare, or how to prepare, you know, more like in the future, should there be another hurricane, as we continue to deal, you know, with this surge of COVID-19 cases.
Reynaldo Leaños Jr. is a reporter covering immigration and the U.S.-Mexico border for Texas Public Radio, and Tom Frank is a climate impacts reporter at E&E News. Thanks to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
From hospitals to grocery stores, essential workers throughout the country have put their lives at risk serving the public since the pandemic began. And while some employers have provided their essential workers with protective equipment like masks and hand sanitizer, as businesses around the country begin to reopen, there's one big question that looms large. Who is liable if someone gets sick? Now, a new Senate Republican coronavirus aid proposal released yesterday wants to protect employers if employees or customers get the virus. Labor unions and Democrats like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer have said that those protections only reduce the responsibility of employers and put more workers at risk. Michael Sainato is a journalist with The Guardian. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thanks for having me on.
Something I've been thinking about for a while. I just went to finally get a haircut after 5 or 6 months, and I had to fill out a liability form saying if I got sick, the establishment or the hairdresser was not liable for that. Kind of shocked me. Is that the norm now? Are you seeing that popping up in a lot of places?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it at Disney World. A lot of places, customers are being asked to waive liability in returning to, you know, places of business where they are at risk. For instance, it says right on Disney's website that they're not liable at all for people coming back to the parks.
At the end of the day, it's a choice. A lot of people don't have a choice. These are the workers we're talking about. And when an employee gets sick from coronavirus at work, Michael, have employers been held liable, especially if that employee ends up in the hospital or, God forbid, ends up dying?
No, they haven't. And we've seen this since the beginning of the pandemic. And that's been a source of a lot of worker organizing around the country, is workers protesting and organizing in response to outbreaks at work and a lack of response from employers, whether that comes from a lack of personal protective equipment to not providing workers with paid sick leave when they do get sick, and just a lack of transparency from employers and how many workers are getting sick, and a lack of contact tracing. Almost every worker I've spoken to during this pandemic has had concerns about when coworkers have gotten sick. There's very little effort done by the employer to let people know they were working in this department or this area. Maybe any workers who were in contact with this person should get tested or quarantine, you know, things like that. And that's happening in a variety of industries.
There's a couple of opposing forces here. There's the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, otherwise known as OSHA. They have issued guidelines for the coronavirus. What are some of those guidelines, and have those been effective so far, Michael?
They haven't been effective so far because they're just guidelines. There's no accountability. They have proposed guidelines for employers to follow, like wearing masks, putting up partitions to prevent a barrier from, you know, customers and frontline workers, cleaning protocols. But at the same time, OSHA isn't conducting inspections. There's been thousands and thousands of complaints to OSHA from worried workers, and the majority of those have been closed without inspection. What will happen is OSHA will send a letter to the employer. The employer responds, "We're doing the best we can," and then the case gets closed. You know, some workers have filed lawsuits against OSHA alleging that they need to enact emergency guidelines. Some state OSHA agencies have actually done this, where employers will be held liable. They could be subjected to fines if they're found to not be following state or federal guidelines to protect workers.
Let's talk a little bit about the Republican coronavirus package here when it comes to liability. What are they pushing for right now, Michael? Because it seems like, as we mentioned at the top, the protections here are for employers, not employees. Is that right?
Yes. Basically, what the argument is employers shouldn't have any sort of responsibility if workers wind up getting sick at work, or if customers get sick at work as well. It voids any sort of accountability for the employer. So workers can't sue, they can't, you know, file for any sort of you know, retribution if they do get sick and, you know, wind up passing away. Even if the employer doesn't respond to an outbreak in a way that protects workers. So it leaves workers almost responsible for themselves to enforce and protect themselves. But, you know, at this moment, workers are in an impossible situation. With millions of people filing for unemployment every week, they have to, you know, they don't have a choice to go to work or not. They have to take the shifts that they are provided. They have to take the hours that they can. You know, if you have a job right now, you're lucky to have one. given the state of the economy. So it really gives employers a way out of reopening and the risks associated with that.
I'm wondering, Michael, what types of workers have you been talking to when we talk about workers? Are we talking up and down, you know, the line in terms of, you know, people who are working in supermarkets, minimum wage jobs, all the way up to hospital employees? Like, what types of workers are most concerned about this right now?
Across the board, nurses, hospital staff, frontline workers, grocery store workers. As more places have reopened, restaurants, things like that, to, you know, manufacturing hubs, warehouses, delivery workers, all the service industry workers, you know, all the people that are in constant contact with the public are putting themselves at risk right now. As coronavirus cases are, you know, increasing in many parts of the U.S., a lot of the major corporations, despite the increased risks and the increased workloads, a lot of these workers are faced with right now. You know, a lot of the cleaning, the disinfecting, the protecting themselves and protecting the people they're coming in contact with, that responsibility is placed on them.
What happens to workers now? We're looking at layoffs in a lot of different industries. Is that right?
A lot of different industries are still laying off workers, whether it's as the PPP loans are expiring, businesses that have had to close again after reopening because of surge in coronavirus cases, to just industries that have survived up until this point without laying off workers, either companies announcing or warning that mass layoffs are imminent, like some of the large airlines. United Airlines said by October, you know, 36,000 workers are possibly subjected to getting permanently laid off or furloughed. American Airlines has said that. There's been a lot of university systems who are making decisions right now to cut a lot of workers. There was a study a few weeks ago by the Economic Policy Institute that a large portion of workers who have lost their jobs during the pandemic, those jobs are not coming back. Those workers will not have a job that they had before the pandemic to return to. And a lot of industries, even if they have started to reopen, like hotels and things like that, they're not at seeing capacity or demand to the point where they're recalling all their workers. And the ones that are getting recalled, they might only get a few shifts, you know, a week. They're not getting full schedules.
Is there any silver lining in any of this, Michael? Is there anything positive that we can say about workers in the United States right now? Because this is a very serious and grim picture that we're painting, which is necessary. But are there any bright spots, I'm wondering?
Not too many. I think some of the bright spots, if there are any at all, have been the workers who have organized protests, strikes. Workers still organizing to form labor unions or organizing with their existing labor unions to push back on employers or bad practices within their industry. The urgency for organizing has certainly intensified because of the working conditions caused by the pandemic. But there was a report in the Economic Policy Institute in December 2019. U.S. employers spend around $340 million on union avoidance consultants. About one in five union election campaigns involves a charge that an employer has illegally fired a worker. We've seen that during the pandemic with the Amazon protests. A lot of the workers who led those protests have been fired, have lost their jobs. A lot of workers are seeing the benefits of collective organizing and having a collective voice. It's been inspiring to see these workers on the front lines that are still working during the pandemic to protest and risk their jobs to improve their working conditions and you know, raise awareness of how workers in these industries are treated, you know, across the board around the country.
Michael Sinato is a journalist with The Guardian. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. All this week, we've been looking at how much has changed in the 30 years since the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed. The ADA prohibited discrimination against people with disabilities in the United States, and that included physical barriers, everything from sidewalks to subway stations. And yet, decades later, these obstacles still exist in many cities across the country. According to a recent study from the academic journal Cities, 65% of curb ramps and 48% of sidewalks are not accessible for people with disabilities today. Joining me to talk about all this is Amy Hemrahi, an associate professor of medicine, health, and society at Vanderbilt University, and author of the book Building Access, Universal Design and the Politics of Disability. Amy, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the numbers I just cited, 65% of curb ramps and 48% of sidewalks are not accessible 30 years after the ADA. What's up with that?
Well, it probably has to do with a few things. The first is that the law was not set up to create a sudden overnight transformation. It was set up to create gradual transformations in the built environment, and many parts of the law were created in negotiation with businesses and with other entities. And this has created a lot of slowness and loopholes in the enforcement of the ADA. Basically, if someone wants a curb cut on the sidewalk in front of their business or their house, they have to wait until it's time for the sidewalk reconstruction in order to add that, or they have to sue someone on an individual basis in order to get it. And so it's a very slow process. And of course, businesses and cities could voluntarily do this of their own volition, but they often don't do it because they are waiting for someone to basically enforce the ADA on them.
What are some of the, I mean, we just mentioned the curbsides, and we're talking about, you know, even here in New York City, trying to get around to some of the subway stations if they don't have an elevator, for example, or an escalator, which many subway stations do not have, that can be almost an impossible task depending on the disability. So are we seeing other major physical barriers throughout our cities, and maybe cities that don't have subways?
Yes, there are so many types of barriers that come up in cities because cities, of course, are such complex built systems. There are things about how people move around. There are things about how people receive information. So in addition to the types of mobility barriers that you were just mentioning, like the absence of curb ramps or the absence of an elevator into a metro station, a subway station, there are things like crossing lights that only have visual signals but not sound signals. So blind people may not have the information that they need to know when to cross the street. There are accessibility issues that come up around what we call wayfinding, which is signage that tells us where to go. If that information is only visual and it's not available in other formats, then a lot of people will not be able to access it. There are also new forms of barriers that are arising as technology changes that are not covered by the ADA. So one example that I have experienced is that as cities move toward incorporating more LED lighting into streetlights and things like that, a lot of people actually get migraines from LED lighting, or it triggers seizures, or it triggers eye twitches. And so being able to go out into public space at night becomes quite a challenge if all of the lighting is LED. And, you know, so this is kind of like a tension that's been created through efforts to save energy, but that also have an effect on people's experience of public space.
Amy, it's interesting because you say that this is something that sort of get these fixes happen. They're not proactive, right? And I'm wondering, why have so many places just failed to comply with the ADA? and whether there is a body that is, you know, enforcing these standards or not.
That's a great question. So the Department of Justice enforces the standards, and there are ways for to create accountability, and it really depends on localities as well. And so there are certain types of structures that that there are people who come and check to see if they're accessible in order to issue permits and codes and things like that. And then there are others that, you know, elements of them, unless a city is requiring that they be accessible, it really requires someone to bring an ADA complaint. And this is an issue with the way that the law is structured, is that it's so individual. And this applies also to the ADA in other areas like employment, where it really takes the time and energy of individual people to bring complaints and bring lawsuits in order to create changes. And so it's a very slow process. You know, one can imagine that even in the process of entering such a complaint, you might get exhausted, or you may run out of the resources, like legal or financial resources, to follow through.
And you know, I'm wondering, as we're talking, are these ADA compliant, or are the expectations that come out of the ADA, do those also affect private buildings, private ownership, like apartment buildings, for example? Or are we just talking about public structures, like streets?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Title 3 of the ADA is places of public accommodation, and that includes businesses, like basically any place that provides a service or access to a member of the public.
Are there specific cities, Amy, that might serve as a model for the vision that you're seeing as becoming more inclusive for residents with disabilities? Is any place close to getting it better or right?
That's a very good question. There are cities where disabled people have fought very hard to make them more inclusive, and they're far from perfect, but I can give some examples. The classic example is in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is a very hilly, kind of like densely populated place. Since the 1960s, disability activists have fought very hard to get curb cuts, to get BART stations, which is Bay Area Rapid Transit, that have elevators. And it's imperfect, but accessibility exists to a greater extent than other places. And so many disabled people move there and live there in community. There are also examples of cities that were primarily developed, or some of their infrastructures were primarily developed during the age of disability rights law. So in 1968, when Congress passed the Architectural Barriers Act, federal systems and spaces had to follow some minimal guidelines for accessibility. And in places like Washington, D.C., where the subway system was developed kind of right in the aftermath of the Architectural Barriers Act, we see some examples of accessibility that don't exist in other places. It's definitely not perfect. There's still a lot of access barriers that exist, but you can kind of look for places where there are a lot of disabled people in public space to be able to tell whether the infrastructures are supportive or not.
Amy, we are in the middle still of a global coronavirus pandemic, and as a result of that, people are really rethinking, at least here in New York City, how they get around. People were, you know, concerned about taking public transportation, so lots of options that people decided were, you know, walking or biking. Does this present an opportunity to rethink how our cities are operating this coronavirus pandemic? And did it really allow, given the fact that some people decided to walk or bike instead of getting around in other ways, were people with disabilities limited more so by the coronavirus pandemic?
You know, it's important to remember that the coronavirus pandemic is at its core a disability issue. There are the majority of people who are affected by it have pre-existing conditions and are vulnerable and susceptible to severe complications from coronavirus. And then also, there are so many people becoming disabled now because of the after effects of COVID. And so we are also facing a changing population that's going to need different ways of getting around. And for some people, that may be driving in a car. For some people, that may be walking or biking. But something that came to my attention recently, because there was a big debate on Twitter and other places in the urbanist community. So this is the community of people that includes urban planners and other folks who are concerned with how cities are designed and planned, was whether, you know, in this shift away from driving cars or shift away from using mass transit, if there were opportunities for designing mobility differently. And one of the issues that came up is that many people, you know, if you're having extreme like respiratory issues or fatigue issues, driving in a car is going to be necessary. Riding a bike is not going to be accessible. And that's not to suggest that we shouldn't have infrastructure for bike riding, for example, but just that maybe in the design of cities going forward, we have to shift our expectations of what bodies can do and how they can breathe and be outdoors together and things like that, and design spaces for slowness and respite just as much as we're designing spaces for walkability and bikeability.
Lots to think about. Amy Hamrahi is an associate professor of medicine, health, and society at Vanderbilt University and author of the book Building Access, Universal Design, and the Politics of Disability. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
I never dreamed you'd leave in summer.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And it's summertime right now, but it doesn't really sound like summer. Since so many of us are staying home, we don't seem to have one of those songs that kind of worms its way into your ear and plays everywhere you go, whether that's the bar, the club, or hanging out with some friends at the beach. So I asked John Gonzalez, a staff writer at The Ringer, why he thinks we don't have a summer song this year.
I think we've all lost any semblance or sense of time. It occurred to me the other day that it was summer because a friend of mine who has children was saying that the kids are going back to school, and I thought, well, that can't possibly be right. And then I looked at the calendar and realized that it was. So luckily, there are songs of the summer that endure and that, you know, cross that time divide that we've somehow lost.
But one of those songs that has endured is DJ Jazzy Jeff and Will Smith's classic from the 90s, Summertime. John and I both grew up with the song, but a few years ago, John wrote an article that took it to a whole new level. And when he tried to answer the question, how did Will Smith fit all of those activities into one summer day? So I queued up the song so that John could help take me through it.
Here it is, a groove slightly transformed. Just a bit of a break from the norm. Just a little something to break the monotony of all that hardcore dance that has gotten to be a little bit out of control. It's cool to dance, but what about a groove that soothes and moves romance? Give me a soft, subtle mix. And if it ain't broke, then don't try to fix it. And think of the summer
John,
of
this
the past.
Right now, I think we're doing all right. Seems pretty straightforward. Seems like we're just setting the stage for some summer music, right? I mean, so far, any issues in this initial opening stanzas?
Oh, it's so good. I mean, it takes me... Jazz and Will kill it. It comes in immediately, and it throws me back right to the early 90s. It throws me back to high school and hanging out with my friends, and it's just like they're injecting nostalgia into my veins, and it starts out fantastic. And then he starts to talk about the things that he's going to do or is doing that day, and it makes me think a little bit.
Now your deep investigation here, John, begins to uncover some, as you say, space-time continuum issues.
Nah.
Let's let the audience take a listen, and then I'll have you break it down.
It's late in the day, and I ain't been on the court yet. Hustle to the mall to get me a short set. Yeah, I got on sneaks, but I need a new pair, because basketball courts in the summer got girls there.
The temperature's about 88. Hop in the water plug, just for old time's sake. Break to your crib, change your clothes once more, cause you're invited to a barbecue to start at 4.
John.
Yeah.
Okay, this is where things start to get tricky, I'll say, because it's late in the day.
It is. This is a good point that you caught on, and this is part of what made the light bulb go off for me a couple of years ago. It's late in the day. He's got to go to the barbecue at 4. He wants to go and play basketball as well, and he says he's going to run to the mall to pick up some new sneaks because he's got to get good sneaks to look good for potential female paramours who might be at the court watching him. So now we know he was at the Plateau at Fairmount Park, and he's got to go somewhere to find these new sneaks. Now in Philadelphia, if you're going to go to the mall, there's the Gallery at Market East, which is in Center City, and there's one outside the city, but that's too far. So we want to make it as quick as possible. So I actually Google mapped this thing, and it turned out to be about 33 minutes for him to go from the Belmont Plateau to the Gallery. And then if he's going to go to a basketball court, in the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air video, that was shot at Roberto Clemente Park at 18th and Wallace, but that's probably too far out of the way because he lives in West Philly.
Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down, and I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air.
I feel terrible for your listeners now, because now we've really gone down the rabbit hole. So I've got him going into Overbrook High School, which is where he actually went to high school, to play basketball there. So it's 33 minutes round trip and 11.6 miles, but then you've got to get back to the court and play. And I want to know how he finds time to do all this, because late in the day, the barbecue starts at 4, and he's hopping in the water plug for old time's sake.
It's also 88 degrees. So far, mm-hmm. It feels like Mr. Smith here has had a very busy day, but then there's more.
Sitting with your friends, y'all reminisce about the days growing up and the first person you kiss. And as I think back, makes me wonder how the smell from a grill can spark up nostalgia. All the kids playing out front, little boys messing around with the girls playing double dutch. While the DJ spinning a tune as the old folks dance at your family reunion. Then 6 o'clock rolls around, you just finished wiping your car down. Time to cruise, so you go to the summertime hangout. It looks like a car show. Everybody come looking real fine, fresh from the barbershop, a fly from the beauty salon.
Okay. John, the barbecue started at 4.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 6 now. Tell us, what all has Will Smith done in these 2 hours?
He's got to pick out a fly outfit. He is the Fresh Prince after all. He's not going to show up in raggedy duds.
I make this look good.
So I have him arriving a little bit later to pick out the outfit. But on top of this, he says that he just finished wiping his car down. So I'm wondering if he was doing that at the reunion. Is he multitasking in that instance? Mm. Like, is he not fully present? Because that would be disappointing.
No, thank you, I'm fine.
Every moment fronting and waxing, chilling in the car they spent all day waxing. Are we assuming here that Will Smith was waxing his car also?
Well, I guess in theory you could be doing that while you were washing your car or wiping it down, but that's a lot. But then beyond that, and this is the line that threw me, he said everybody comes from the barbershop or the beauty salon looking real fly. Did he get a haircut? When did he get the haircut?
Come on, man, damn.
I mean, if you're going to get the fresh kicks, you got to get the fresh fade too, right?
You got to get it shaped up. I mean, he's a handsome looking man. He wouldn't show up without getting his hair shaped up. However, we're running out of time. And then, okay, as I pointed out, and you pointed out, it's hot that day. And now he is also still spending every moment fronting and maxing. I'd be exhausted.
Let me tell you, I'm just hosting a radio show and it's 95 degrees and I don't have enough time to front and max like that.
Boy, Captain America over here.
But okay, so we've got to see where this ends up. We're going to play this last clip from the song and you're going to take us out, John. Let's take a listen.
Leaning to the side, but you can't speed through 2 miles an hour, so everybody sees you. There's an air of love and of happiness, and this is the Fresh Prince's new definition of summer madness.
John, I mean, at the end of the day, we go out and we're still chilling and maxing, but there's an air of love and happiness. Is that enough for this song to remain a classic despite some of its logistical questions that it raises?
It is indeed. This song has a super special place in my heart. When I wrote the song and tweeted it out, you noticed it. but also James Poyser from The Roots and Jazz noticed it and tweeted at me and said it's possible, so I'll take their word for it.
John Gonzalez is staff writer at The Ringer. John, this was a lot of fun. Thanks so much.
What a delight. Thanks for having me.
Well, on that summertime note, I hope you're all staying cool no matter how many activities you try to squeeze into your day. Remember, we want to keep hearing your favorite summer songs, so give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway or tweet me at Tanzina Vega. And that's our show for today, everybody. I'll be back here tomorrow with more stories. If you missed anything or want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Send us your summer songs. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.